This is Kevin Barry, and I'm delighted to talk about my new novel, The Heart in Winter.
In Kevin Barry's new novel, The Heart in Winter, an Irish immigrant living in Butte, Montana, falls in love with another man's mail-order bride. The pair runs away from the jilted husband, who will do whatever it takes to stop them. The hardships they endure throughout the harsh Montana winter result in a tale about forbidden love and the melting of cultures. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Kevin Barry. Can you set this book up for us? Tell us about The Heart in Winter. What is its origin story?
Well, actually, it goes back quite a while, to the summer of 1999, when I was a very young man. I was 29 years old, and I decided I was going to write my novel. The time had come to write that novel, boy, you know. So I was working as a freelance reporter journalist at the time in Cork, in Ireland, and I decided I'm going to save up enough money to have 3 months to go and write a novel or make a good start on one. And I went down to the County Cork coast, and I bought an old caravan, a trailer, and I sat in it for 3 months to write my novel, and I had nothing. You know, I had absolutely nothing. And I started going for long, bitter, tormented walks in the mountains in West Cork. And one day I came across these abandoned copper mines. Oh, okay, that's interesting. And I started to research it. And it turned out that the mines had played out in the 1880s. And all the copper miners from County Cork en masse moved to Butte, Montana, because the mines were booming there. Electrification had started in the United States. So I thought, wow, this is a Western put with Irish accents. I'm in. I have a way in. All I need to do is get to Butte, Montana.
You know, I read in The Guardian that this was 25 years in the works, but I was wondering what that story was.
That's not just my shtick. It actually all started 25 years ago. I went to Butte then, is what happened. In October 99, it was my first trip to the US, flew to Seattle and got on a Greyhound bus for many years it seemed to take to get out to Butte, Montana. It took about 14 hours. And I got great material for a novel. I got all this lovely kind of ripe stuff about the bars and brothels and the opium parlors in the 1890s, and what had happened, these 10,000 crazy Irish men who had landed themselves a mile high in the Rocky Mountains. So I had this great material for a novel and great kind of texture. And I went back to Cork and I wrote about 100,000 words, and it was all dead on the page. I just knew it wasn't alive or vivacious in any kind of way, despite the great material. And I slowly, poignantly kind of shoved it to one side, and eventually managed to write six other books. And 22 years passed, and it was by this point late in the pandemic. And I was walking in the woods one day near home, and I thought, if you're in the woods, you're in a Western. All you need is some imagination. And then I kind of had a vision, a little image in my mind that settled of a young man and woman riding double on a horse. And I thought, if they're riding double, they're in trouble. They need to get out of someplace fast. And I thought, what if it's Butte, Montana? Because I know that world. I have that world. And it's just that's how long the characters for this novel took to show themselves, you know. So it's a very kind of slow game sometimes. You have to be patient, and you have to wait for the characters to emerge from the mist of time and see what you can do at that point.
I want to talk about your characters because, and I'm really bad at this, but we learn the story from a third person limited point of view. And sometimes it's Tom's perspective, sometimes it's Polly, sometimes it's both. We meet Tom Rourke first. He writes, and this is a quote, "songs for the bars and letters for the lonesome." What else should we know about Tom?
Well, he's a disaster of a young man. He's an absolute disaster. It's maybe not entirely uncoincidental that I was 29, as he is in the book, when I went to Butte. He's a very exaggerated version. You know, he's a doper, he's a drinker, he's a mess, he's in the brothels, he's in trouble all the time. He's also a young man of literary ambition, and I know what that feels like. It's a very elevated condition to find yourself in life, and also an absolute disaster most of the time. But he can't really find a way in. He writes bits of poems, he writes ballads for the bars, and he does write these letters for miners who were searching for bribes back east. And this was actually a job that existed in Butte at the time. There were these guys who would write you a letter in the bar looking for a wife. A lot of the miners, the Irish miners, were illiterate. A lot of them just wouldn't have been comfortable writing to a woman. They wouldn't know what to say. But Tom has this kind of silver-tongued way with him, and he can pen the letters in that way. And it's through this kind of strange transaction and commerce that went on that Polly Gillespie arrives into Butte as the mail order bride of a mining captain, another Irishman called Harrington, very devout religious man. And things are going to go awry very quickly.
You know, you mentioned Polly Gillespie. What does the world look like through her lens?
You know, I think when I started to write the novel, you become a little bit more economical with time. And I said, okay, I'm going to give this 2 weeks and I'll see if anything gets going for me. I'll give Tom a week and I'll give Polly a week. And as you say, I write kind of close third person with her point of view very closely, almost going into first person sometimes. So I wrote the first week. I was writing Tom, and it's pretty much as the book opens, he's lurching around town one night on this kind of demonic pub crawl, brothel crawl, opium house crawl. And I thought this feels promising. I felt like I was naturally getting the world of the story as he lurched around the town. And I also kind of believed in him as this kind of tormented, doomed feeling, kind of 29-year-old wannabe kind of poet. The second week I spent working on the book, I was more nervous because Polly is a directly American voice. She's this young woman from Chicago who's just landed. But I went in Monday morning and I started to write. And after about 15 minutes writing from Polly's point of view, I said to myself, "You have a novel. It's here." She was just ready, you know? And that's the kind of the great mysterious trick to it, is figuring out what's ready for you to write on your desk. Often when it's early in a writer's career, ambition and ability aren't quite in proper balance. You're often trying to write books that you're just not ready for yet, that you're kind of years away maybe from writing. But as soon as I started writing in Polly Gillespie's point of view, that early morning I spent on the book, I just thought, yeah. She's very sure of herself. She's very comfortable in her own skin. She knows who she is. Thomas has no idea who he is and is searching for an identity and is trying on different kind of roles, outlaw, poet. Polly remarks at one point he was trying on versions of himself as if they were jackets. But they really like the look of each other. They like the way they look together as a couple. And it's kind of significant, I think, that when they first meet in the book early on, it's in a photographic studio, because this is the time when 1891, so every little main street in North America suddenly has a photo studio in it. And for the very first time in human history, very ordinary, very working class people are thinking about their image, and they're thinking about how they look, and they're projecting an image. And here's a portrait I've had made that I'm going to send back to my mother in Ireland, or whatever, you know what I mean? And Tom and Polly are very taken with the way they look, and they're trying on airs all the time. And it's almost like they're seeing it from above. It's remarked a couple of times as if this is a film that's playing out for them and they're watching it. They know that this relationship is the great drama in their lives. They know that maybe you get something like this once in your life, this mad, great, dramatic narrative that you know you're going to go follow down this road and see what happens with this. And they feel kind of cursed and blessed, I think, both to have this realization.
I want to talk about religion because you mentioned the religion of Harrington, and you mentioned the first night we meet Tom, and this is a quote, "He lost his faith in God again around 4:30 in the morning." And Polly is turned off by her first husband's religious practices, and there's a time when she asks Tom, "Do you believe in God the Almighty?" And he replies, "No, but I'm in discussions with him." And you know, I wonder if you can talk to me about the role that religion plays in this book.
Yeah, I guess I was trying as much as possible to be very true to the period and to a young, artistically minded Irishman in 1891. You can tell he is from somewhat an educated background. I think one of the main great wrestling philosophical debates going on in his head all the time is there a God? do I believe in God? Am I with God? Am I not? And he can't make up his mind. And he's in and out all the time with God. He's in constant negotiations with God about the matter of your belief or otherwise. There's a great quote, and I can never attribute quotes that I use, but it's possibly from Iris Murdoch, who said that the problem when Irishmen stop believing in God is suddenly they believe in everything else instead. And Tom is definitely gone down this road. He believes in magic. He believes in an other world. He believes himself to be a kind of witch. There's a lot going on in this young man's head, and it's not in any kind of balance at any point.
I tend to appreciate when authors read their own audiobook because we can hear the words the way you intended them. Was that your plan with this book, or how did it come about? Because I both read and listened at the same time, so I heard your voice in my head.
I won't let those professional actors anywhere near my audiobooks. I insist on doing them myself. I'm kind of a frustrated ham actor, as you'll be aware if you've listened to one of my audiobooks. I do all the voices and I do all the accents, but I do it even as I'm writing. I do act it out all the time. And even if I have like a very rough first draft, I will be kind of listening to it all the time because it's a great shortcut. You find all the evasions in your story when you hear them on the air quicker than you would looking at them on a screen. But yeah, I'm really happy at the way audiobooks have become such a thing in the last few years. Like my theory is that it's opening out from people listening to podcasts so much. That just experience of longer form listening, and it's spread into fiction, which is great. But I take it very seriously as a form in itself, the audiobook. I think it's at a point where it's almost, not just this other version of the novel you get, but it can be its own thing. And I actually feel, I felt w recording this one and my last novel, Nightboat to Tangier, that the audiobook was almost a full expression of that story in a way, I do think I kind of write to be heard to some degree. But yeah, it's hard work actually doing them. The actual recording is 3 days of hard work. And it's also the point where the text is finished and you can't change it if you find anything you want to change at the last minute, that moment is gone. But it's hard work, but I rehearse for it. I take it seriously. I spend months beforehand sort of practicing the accents and all that.
So this is a Western with very Irish diction. The book is both distinctly Irish and American. Was blending the two cultures ever challenging?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about Butte Montana as a world in the 1890s is that I could do it completely as a little Irish city because there were 10,000 of them out of a population of 30,000. So it was a third Irish. But it's a very interesting melting pot as well, because wherever there were mines anywhere in Europe, word went around about great dollars to be made in Butte, Montana. And they appeared from Poland, from Croatia, from all over, miners from South America. So it was a crazy mad melting pot out there at that time. So it was nice to see the Irish kind of energy in that and the Irish kind of version of it. And we've always been like Irish people. We've always been a nation of economic refugees, We almost invented it as a thing, going around the world, chancing our arm and looking for jobs wherever, And we've always been kind of good at it as well, at economic migrancy. We're kind of quite pleasant people and very chatty, and we get on well in places. But there's also a kind of a native canniness about how new societies organize themselves. And it's very interesting to see the way that worked in Butte with the Irish there. Like they started by opening lots of little businesses, often pubs, and from there, very quickly, they took over the police apparatus of the city. And then they took over the political apparatus of the city. And if you went back to Butte 10 years after this novel is set, it's a complete little Irish machine kind of town, as it remained for many decades. So it's an interesting place to look at Irish America in a kind of a microcosm, in this tiny version of like a Chicago or a Boston or a New York.
Readers quickly become invested in Tom and Polly's love story, but there's another love story at hand, and that's, with the land. There's this harsh Montana landscape that, works with them and against them. Talk to me about the landscape as a almost a character in and of itself.
I have always loved a snow western. I just love that Snow West, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, things like that. From those kind of great 1970s American westerns, the revisionist westerns. I always loved those Terrence Malick movies, Badlands and Days of Heaven from the 70s, and both use a fantastic female voiceover to knit the story together. Those voiceovers were very important for Polly's voice as kind of a tuning fork for the way she sounds. But yeah, I think they're moving through the country and they can't quite believe in themselves on this kind of odyssey. You know, it says at one point they can't get any purchase on the geography. But of course, when you put two characters on a horse and send them into the woods, there's also an element of it becoming a fairy story at that point. And there are going to be strange encounters that will have to play out in whatever way. And there's a special dreaminess about the idea of the forest or the woods in winter, with the bare trees and the grey white sky, and just a sense of kind of space and openness and all sorts of possibility.
I want to stay at Providence. Can you tell me where that cabin is?
Providence is there. They stumble across an old cabin that's probably a huntsman's cabin in the woods, and they manage to hole up here for a kind of a their great romance that kind of has a little moment of perfection before the story takes other turns without giving too much away. But they have a blessed little idyll in the moment of it there, and it was very touching stuff to write. I was quite carried away on the emotion of it, I have to admit. I got very close to them, the two characters, when I was working on the book, Tom and Polly, you know, because it went quite quickly. I wrote it in slightly less than a year once I had the image of them. But I was never so happy to kind of get out of my bed in the morning and go to my desk, you know. I was that's not always the case. And I kind of really resided with them a lot. I was thinking about them a lot outside of the writing hours, even just kind of living with them and not even putting them into dramatic situations or anything in my head, but just thinking about how are they getting on. And yeah, it was very miserable at the end when I finished the book. I really missed them, you know. I was lonely for the two of them.
Okay, so this novel was 25 years in the making. What's next for you?
I've been like I have way too many irons in the fire, really. I've been working on a stage play that hopefully will see the light of day early next year. It's called A Cave, about two brothers who have moved into an old cave in County Sligo in the mountains. And I've also been writing the screenplay of Night Boat to Tangier, the last novel, and that project is at a good advanced stage now. So yeah, and thoughts are slowly turning to what might be the next novel. There are always kind of competing ideas, but you never know when something is going to blindside you, when something comes from a very old idea or something from the way distant past, as was the case with The Heart in Winter. One thing that was very important, I guess, in the writing of the novel was the musical tradition in Butte, Montana, and the tradition of ballad making. These kind of free for hire kind of poet types who went around the place, and like different mines would get these guys to write ballads for their mine, to say that they were the toughest miners and the hardest workers and the best drinkers and the best fighters and the most, you know, crazy for women and all of that. So you'd have these competing balladeers working around town to put this stuff together, and it's left behind some great textures that you can draw on for a novel. I never say never about what the next book might be, and I'm always kind of wary of repeating myself and going back to old ground. But that said, Butte, Montana feels like very good fictional real estate for me now. So you never know, in the future I might find myself climbing again.
Well, the book is The Heart in Winter. Kevin Barry, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me in. Thank you.
That was Kevin Barry, author of the book The Heart in Winter, which was published by Doubleday. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Here's Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.